Up first this hour, though, we welcome back to the program from Defector, co-host of the Distraction Podcast, our friend David Roth. Hello there, David.
Hey, Rich. How are you doing?
Well, as we were chatting there before we came on, cold. It's that point in the winter, it finally got here where you're like, you know, if it all ended like this, I'd be okay.
Yeah, this is a conversation I was having with my wife just yesterday night about, we're both kind of wondering why we were, you know, ill-tempered, feeling sort of frustrated with just things in general. And there's reasons for it. We're busy. We got other things going on. But at some point, we just arrived at the fact that we're like, this month sucks. It's just always bad. We have to stop being surprised by that. And like, that doesn't necessarily mean that we're going to do a better job navigating it in a way that makes us less insane. But yeah, I'm feeling pretty January over here. It's been like 20-odd degrees and the sun hasn't come up in 3 days. I don't love that.
That's the worst part. Yeah, I can take the cold, I can take the snow, but it's that those long stretches of gray.
Yeah, it's hard. I mean, it's one of those things where I guess this is, you know, it doesn't quite qualify as a new observation if it happened during my lifetime, because I'm not, you know, a new person. But it is weird to think that, like, I was, like, in college by the time anybody had come up with the idea of seasonal affective disorder. You know, like, I think people just for a while noticed that everyone drinks a lot more during the wintertime. No one knows why. And now it seems like we've more or less landed on the fact that this month, the month after that, not so great. And then that's why I think that's part of why I'm always so grateful when spring training starts up. I'm like, God, just anything. Like, show me. It's about as much like seeing green grass under sunshine at that point as it is about watching, you know, whatever, Sean Manea loosen up for the Mets.
No, I know the feeling completely. We here in New England, we're so desperate for anything like that. We celebrate Truck Day when the Fenway Park truck gets loaded up and begins its journey to Florida. People are like, it'll be over eventually.
Yeah, it's one of those things where, like, you can be aware of how pathetic it is and still cling to it, like, with both hands, and I 100% relate to that. I mean, this is one of the things that I've been talking to friends and coworkers about this, too, that this offseason has felt a little bit longer baseball-wise than, you know, already it has. I think just because, like, all of our teams are sort of not really doing very much. Mm. It turns out, unless you're a Dodgers fan, there's not really that much to get that excited about. And so we've all just been kind of white-knuckling it and being like, wow, 7 more weeks, huh? That seems like more than I thought. I thought it was 6 last week. And, you know, whatever. We'll be all right. But, yeah, it's tough. I would be looking forward to Truck Week pretty heartily if I were you.
Well, and there's some pleasures to be found. And for me, it's some sort of schadenfreude, I guess. But, you know, when the Cowboys lose a playoff game, that just continues to give me joy after all these years.
Yeah, I want to believe I'm above it, but I'm absolutely not. That was definitely one of those. It was a pretty miserable game to watch, just in the sense that, you know, it wasn't competitive. And a lot of the, like, there was at least one Packers touchdown in that game. The Luke Musgrave one, the pass to the tight end, I think is the most open I've ever seen anyone be in an NFL game.
Oh yeah, they had to go to the satellite picture to show a defender somewhere.
Right. I was gonna say, like, you need the all 11 footage or the all 22 to see where everybody else was, because otherwise it is the same visual as like a center fielder camped under a pop-up hit right at him. Like, it was just green grass, one little guy, a ball very slowly coming towards him, and nobody else. But that said, you know, it was happening to the Cowboys, so there was a part of me that was kind of like, yeah, I bet you could get somebody more open than that. Try it. See what you can do.
I also, for some reason, because I haven't minded them that much in the past, but I took a little pleasure out of the Eagles going belly up.
Yeah, there was a bunch of teams that, the Eagles being maybe the most obvious example, the Dolphins are also in this class for me, that just, like, it seemed like it was time for them to go on vacation. Like, either they had too many guys hurt, or they were just kind of sick of hanging around each other. The Eagles, I feel like we're probably can start counting down the days until whatever, we get the big long reported story in The Athletic or The Inquirer or whatever about what was wrong there. We had Dan McQuaid at Defector wrote this, like, sort of running bit all year, you know, through the first 11 weeks when the Eagles were 10-1, that was basically about how upset Eagles fans all were about the team all the time. And it was like sort of a bit and sort of not, because he would be, you know, like they would win a game and then he would talk to, you know, about all the people calling into the, you know, WIP, the local radio. Like, I don't really like the blocking and the interior line. Like, also, I had some thoughts about policing. And they'd be like, all right, cut them off. In this case, it's like that became, over the course of a year, went from being a bit to being like actually and unassailably true that the team was, for regardless of how good their record was, they were straight bad the last 6 weeks of the year. And like not bad in the sense of being like, you know, overmatched or whatever. It was the same talented guys that have gotten them to the Super Bowl. It was just like they somehow everything curdled at once.
What happens, do you think, to Jim Harbaugh, and why do we care?
So what I want to happen to Jim Harbaugh is that he just continues becoming more and more like Jim Harbaugh until eventually he becomes pure light. I think he needs to, like, I want a Dr. Manhattan style career arc for him at Michigan. I worry that he's going to do something dorky, like go coach the Chargers or something, and then everybody's going to have to think differently about him. But I want to believe that this, I mean, obviously this is his moment of greatest triumph. He's done the thing that everybody involved with Michigan football wants to do, which is not just win a title, but do it in a way that really annoys the entire rest of the United States. And I think in this case, he's, you know, I guess he's proven everything that he needs to prove as a college coach. I feel like, with the exception of how things ended in San Francisco, he's proven that he's a good NFL coach, too. I don't really think, unless he wants to win a Super Bowl, in which case I don't know which of the available jobs would be appealing at this point. I mean, it's like the idea that you want to win a Super Bowl, so you're going to go, what, coach the Washington Commanders? Like, just stay at the job that makes you an icon. But it's hard to tell. This is one of the things that's fun about Jim Harbaugh, is no one knows how his brain works. So I wouldn't even guess at it. I have coworkers that are convinced that he's going to take the Chargers job, or he's going to jump to the NFL, or, you know, the Raiders, or wherever he can go as soon as he can. But I'm sort of hoping he stays. Do you have any, like, have you been as fascinated by him as I have? I know we talked about the Edmund Fitzgerald stuff the last time I was on.
Oh, yeah, because he is one of a kind in so many ways. And, yeah, I don't know what it is about him that fascinates me and also irritates me on a regular basis.
Yeah, he's the most intense that a person can be, I think, without, like, you know, really spiking your aneurysm risks or whatever. But he's intense in such a strange and idiosyncratic way. Like, I think he's really just like this. And I don't think there's anybody else that's really like this. Like, if you take, like, Dan Campbell is a very intense, while we're talking about Michigan men, is a very intense individual as well. But it's worlds away. Like, he's intense like a football coach. I don't know what Jim Harbaugh is or where the thoughts come from. And so there's a great bit in Ben Mathis Lilly's book about Michigan football, which I recommend. Recommended, but I forget what the title of it is. But whatever, the guy writes for Slate. And he's a Michigan fan. He spent a year following the team around and wrote kind of a fun book about it. And he talks about being at like a youth football camp where Harbaugh and some other coaches were speaking to, like, you know, middle school and high school kids. And the coaches did, the other ones, you know, came in and did their best, like the stuff that you would expect from a football coach at a football camp, you know, talk about the importance of respecting the game and, you know, being prepared and trying your best and all that. And Harbaugh gave a speech which really says seemed like basically improvised, but very heartfelt, where he was talking about how with elite racehorses, their hearts beat so intensely that you can see it from the outside. You can feel it. And it's like, it's just think about all these middle school kids who are like, when's lunch? And this weird man is either not blinking at all or blinking at hummingbird speed and being like, you got to be the horse's heart. It's just like really gratifying to me to think about someone like that out there in the world, not committing crimes and just like doing as normal a job as that sort of person could do.
My problem is this. I need somebody to be the lightning rod for my disgust with big time college football. So if Harbaugh goes and with Saban gone, am I going to have to start paying attention to Lane Kiffin?
Yeah, I feel like that's the part of it that's kind of frustrating. You have to kind of like check down to, you know, the things that are left are basically, it's boosters, you know, and the general way that, like, Florida State University's athletic department carries itself. All of that is ridiculous, but except for, I think, for Dabo Swinney at Clemson, I think is an old, that is a guy that all Americans can hate. Like, whatever, I mean, like, I have my own sort of political, cultural, you know, biases that I can bring to bear on it, but you could believe the exact opposite of me about every single issue and still find a way to not like him. But the rest of it, yeah, it's kind of like thinning out. Like, I don't know what, like, what is his name? Kalen DeBoer, the Washington guy that's in the Alabama job. Like, he just seems like a football coach, too. Like, he's one of those dudes that, you know, this is the only job he's ever had. He's been really good at it. He's not, like, objectionable, though, like, in the ways that your real, like, institutionalized college football presences are. Give him time, I guess. You know, Alabama has a way of doing that to people.
We're talking with David Roth here on Downtown. All right, we're all giddy in New England about the Boston Celtics, 32 wins at the halfway mark. From the outside New England perspective, are they as good as we think?
Yeah, I think they're really good. I mean, it's hard, you know, it's different than, like, in baseball, where the team that wins the World Series seems to have very little to do with which team is best during the year. It's hard in basketball to do it, but I kind of feel like they figured out ways to improve on what was already a very, very good team. And I think that the moves that they've made sort of around the edges, I mean, like, Jrue Holiday is not a fringe play or whatever, but that, like, I don't see weaknesses in the ways that, even on, you know, the teams that they had that were good, even in the last few years. I mean, you saw, like, last year, you know, Jaylen Brown's limitations and Jason Tatum's health wound up basically being the difference, you know, and then Marcus Smart, as much as everybody loved him, there were things that he could do and there were things he could not do as well. At this point, it is, like, a pretty seamless whole. They play very well together. And I don't want to say that, like, Jaylen Brown looks better or whatever, you know, like, he's been really good. He's got a supermax contract for a reason. It just feels, and, you know, the playoffs are different. I don't see as many areas in which there's, like, a risk of exposure. And, you know, the more I watch them, the more maybe I'll see it. Every time I've watched them, they've looked like the best team in the NBA to me. Like, I just have really, really been impressed.
Well, they're not having the mental lapses or the concentration right. issues they had last year, where they'd be up 18 in the third quarter, and it was almost like they, Brown and Tatum, looked at each other and said, let's let it get close and see if we can come back and win.
Yeah, and that's the sort of thing where, you know, good teams can do that. Like, they can, you know, they can still win those games against teams that are less talented than them. It's infuriating as a fan, and I do think that it's, like, a red flag to a certain extent. That, like, there's, you know, every team is, they're not only going to be perfect, you know, but the way that the Nuggets went through the playoffs last year was, it's the exception, you know, to the normal rule there, which is, like, teams will get pushed and you'll have to see how good they are. It's really hard to just sort of be a tick better than every team you play all the way through. And, you know, I don't know that, again, like you said, like, the mental stuff is, and has always been, I think, the challenge there. You know, it's a long season. The playoffs are incredibly long and arduous. Like, even if the Celtics can manage to get through it, you know, with less attrition, that's been the challenge for them. I mean, I'd love to see them just play some clean postseason series. They played a lot of really dramatic seven gamers the last few years, and beyond taking a lot out of the players and stuff like that, I think it also, as a fan, it would stress me out. If I cared about them, I would be like, why is this not, like, why are we playing seven games instead of five or four every time? But I don't know, maybe this is the year they answer that.
All right, so are you doing anything on social media? I know you kept the X account open, but you haven't posted in a while. Am I missing your work on one of these other platforms? Because I need my fix of David Roth on a more regular basis.
I appreciate that. I'm on Blue Sky most of the time.
Oh, okay. I'm on there, but I've done nothing.
Yeah, I think that's the way that most people, I think, have used it. There's some activity on there. I think a lot of people sort of, you know, homesteaded a spot with their name on it, which is
right.
I mean, if that's what you did,
that's what I did, and I'm doing more on Threads, and that, which is not a bad place either.
Yeah, so I've never tried Threads. That's just because the Facebook stink on it, but I've right. heard from people that use it that it is actually like pretty good, works fine, like is less insane. The thing with Twitter that I've done, I mean, this is like, you know, I don't think I deserve a pat on the back for this. I just don't look at it anymore. And I think that it's been a lot easier to do, you know, I spent, I don't even want to say it, but like 12, 13 years looking at it all the time, every day, you know, and some of it's for work and some of it, you know, eventually was just, you know, the sheer force of habit and, you know, probably addiction if you want to be clinical with it. And yet there came a point where I just found that I didn't want to do it anymore, that I wasn't having fun looking at it, and that it was more like just kind of making me sad because I was, you know, remembering the old serotonin boosts I used to get there.
Right.
I wasn't getting it anymore. And, you know, every bit that I see of it, I still, you know, like get sent links to, you know, basketball highlights and stuff. And I feel like that's still basically the last bit of value left in the site, is that that's where you go for sports. Blue Sky doesn't have a lot of sports posting on it. It's a lot of politics and a lot of just kind of like goofing around, all of which is fine. I just, you know, I miss my dunks.
Right. And you know, maybe it's without even realizing it, maybe Elmo did something nice for us and is helping us all find a more healthy relationship with social media.
I think that's kind of right. You know, that like, 'cause I think this is what it would have taken. If it was the sort of thing, like all of the, when they were initially, when, you know, Elon's long parade of swell ideas, and there was one that was, you know, like you make people pay for it or whatever, which is a classic innovation. I don't know where he comes up with this stuff. But that was one where I was like, maybe I would, you know, like if I had to, like I wouldn't want to pay a lot, but if I need this for work to know what's going on or whatever, but just by making the site suck, by making the vibes so bad and just turning everything upside down in the most unappealing possible way, it actually, I think the thing that I would have needed to quit was feeling like I just really didn't want it anymore. And he made me not want it, which is, you know, I guess I should send him an edible arrangement. Otherwise, I don't think I ever would have got there.
No, I'm with you on that. Hey, I wanted to ask you this. This time of year, maybe especially this time of year, where it is kind of dark and gray and gloomy, do you have maybe a movie, maybe a TV series, a book, something you go back to, music perhaps, that sort of soothes the soul and picks you up when you need that?
That's a good question. I spent some time listening through. So I had COVID right before Christmas, which is the second time in 3 years that I've had that. Really great stuff. I did get up there in time for the holiday this time.
Oh, good.
But I spent some time sort of like isolating from my wife, and I was in the, you know, what I call the germ chamber, which is basically the office space we have with a futon where you can sleep if you are too, you know, infectious to sleep in a big bed with your wife. And this, I was listening through to some records that I had, like, not just from college. I still have all my CDs and records, basically, that I ever bought. And a lot of the stuff that I listened to back when I was in college, so this would be, like, the Yolotengo record, I Can Hear the Heart Beating Is One, was one for me. There's the Second Ride record, which is a British band that I bought the record. I don't remember buying it. I think it was just one of those things where they were like a sort of a band that people I knew. So I was like, oh, whatever. What else am I going to do with my money from working in the science library at Pomona College? And it was kind of, I wouldn't say that it like made me feel, you know, young or like I did in college, because I was like very aware that I was trapped in the office with COVID listening to compact discs, you know, like I wasn't going to confuse that for being 21 years old in Southern California or whatever. But, it's that sort of association that tends to work for me, you know, that like something that has that like close link to a happier time. Movie wise, the ones that I find myself watching or being able to watch whenever I see them, it's like they're not movies that I find uplifting or whatever. It's easier with music, you know, it's pretty and it reminds you of a time when you were listening to it in your life. The fact that when you said movies, the first one that popped into my head is Michael Clayton. I love Michael Clayton, but that is like, there's a lot of stuff in that movie that isn't really, like, you're not sitting there sort of like chortling with delight the whole time, you know, like it's.
No, but you know, I get that completely, because for me, and I'm kind of the same way with music. I want to listen to something that takes me back, maybe just briefly, to a different time in life. But with movies, especially, I love nothing more than going to like Turner Classic Movies. Give me something in black and white, preferably, you know, with like gangsters and Richard Widmark.
Yeah, that Turner Classic Movies is one of the last great resources of like self-care available in the culture, because it is, I record stuff off of there, you know, I look at it, we still have a DVR, we got a lot of Jurassic technology in the house now that I'm talking about it, but I will go through and like, if there's something that they're showing that I've wanted to see, there's a lot of stuff that is otherwise not available to stream. I recorded, but I've not yet watched the John Huston adaptation of Wise Blood, the Flannery O'Connor.
Oh, movie. Yes, that, yes.
And, you know, I'm really excited to see it, because it's like, in some ways, I don't know how else I would have seen it. It's something I've wanted to see for years, but I don't think it's on DVD, and it's not, you know, airing and on a loop on, you know, HBO or whatever. But it's just scrolling through all of those different movies that they're like kind of ornate 40s and 50s titles, and, you know, just like, I don't really have an opinion on like Richard Widmark or Barbara Stanwyck or whatever. I've enjoyed them when I've seen them and stuff, but just seeing some movie with them in it and knowing more or less that it's going to be high quality, stagey, and from another time, like that definitely sounds like a good way to get out of, you know, whatever, mid-January, mentally and physically.
Absolutely. Listen, I have to talk about Trump World with you. And what I'm fascinated by is Trump's orbit always pulls in strange people and unique human beings that you would not find anywhere else. And this week it has been his crack attorney, Alina Haba.
Yeah, she's been really something. So the one thing that I guess with Trump that, you know, it was not in retrospect very hard for him to completely bust out and take over one of the two big political parties that we have, right? That like the Republicans are not, they don't really exist independent of Trump at this point.
No,
All of their policy platform is, you know, it's when he was running for president, they didn't have a platform in 2020. It was basically like, we're just going to keep doing it. More Trump coming your way. And, you know, they got their butt kicked. They lost by 10.5 million votes. And they're doing the same thing again against the same guy. Because it's, but what's weird about that is, so like, taking over the Republican Party, not hard. Like, you can come in there, you can lie as much as you want, you can do whatever crimes you want. If you have enough recognizable television fame and enough followers or whatever, that works. The one thing that Trump can't do is get a decent lawyer to work for him, which is really fascinating. That like how much more resilient the sort of like cynical self-preservation instinct of that industry is than one of our two big political parties is. Because I think that for the most part, the reason that he's rolling, you know, your Alina Habas and your Sidney Powells out there is that, you know, as I don't think anybody's going to confuse lawyering for like the most honorable of the professions, but like you can get in trouble for lying in court. Like all the things that he makes people do, I think the repercussions for it are way more urgently felt for lawyers. And so what you're left with is like Alina Haba, and I remember I'm forgetting her name now. There was one from New Jersey that he had in one of his other cases, were basically like they're personal injury attorneys whose ads appear on bus stops. Like this is just like, and I'm not to say anything that that's bad or whatever, but it is the sort of thing where like, you'd think this is a former president with hundreds of millions of dollars readily at hand that he could pay to somebody as a retainer, and like I'm assuming that he's just working his way down until he gets to like the most aggressive ambulance chaser in whatever metro area he's in.
Well, and you would think a guy who has spent as much time in court as he has through the years would at least have a few regulars that would stay around, but maybe, you know, the not paying might be part of it, and just putting up with his particular brand of crazy.
Yeah, I think that's a lot of what it is. I think that he doesn't really pay, and he will get you in trouble. And so that's, you can see, you know, the calculus for someone like Alina Haba, like, whatever, she's getting discussed on the radio in Maine. That was not going to happen unless she aligned herself with Trump. The problem is that she's getting discussed on the radio in Maine by two people who have spent the last week being like, what are you doing? Where did they teach you that?
I especially enjoy it when the judge has to walk her through procedures here.
Oh, God, yeah, like just marking stuff. I mean, this is, I'm not a lawyer, right? My parents are lawyers. So I guess I would say that I'm lawyer-coded or whatever. But this has the feeling of that, those like Holiday Inn Express ads, where it's like, if you've watched like enough episodes of, you know, SVU, that you're like, you got to mark that evidence if you're going to admit
it. Right.
Like, anyone could do it from their couch, but she's getting it wrong on TV. Like,
crazy. Hey, what do you think is going on with Trump's hand? Did you see those pictures?
I've heard it described, but I haven't seen it. And I saw that James Carville says that he thinks it's syphilis. Terrific that we still get to think about James Carville in 2024. Oof. We can't leave that behind. But it's weird. Trump has looked strange for the entire time that he's been a public figure, more or less. I mean, he was like a decently handsome young man with weird hair, and then he's become the sex symbol that we all know and love today. But every time I see him now, I'm like a little bit surprised by what's going on there. I haven't seen the hand. And you're welcome to describe it if you'd like.
Well, it's just big sores on the hand. It's as if the evil is finally manifesting itself in rot that we can all see.
That's a tough one. Yeah, the idea that you're like fundamentally going through the transformation that like Bruce Davison's character did in the first X-Men movie.
Yes, like, that's it.
You don't really want that.
No.
There should be medicine for that. Something topical even would probably help. But yeah, it does. I mean, of all the things, he's done a great job in various ways inspiring extremely obvious literary comparisons. I mean, the whole, when he got COVID, that was like, it was like he read The Mask of the Red Death and like didn't read the end of it. It was like, this seems fun. Like, we should throw a party. And this one feels very Dorian Gray, even though I think that, you know, like, even a story of that length is not something that he's going to finish.
Oh, no, no, not at all. Not at all. All right, well, I want to bring it back to sports because your name came up yesterday. We were discussing a book by Brandon Buehler, Front Office Fantasies, The Rise of Managerial Sports Media.
Oh, yeah. I have a galley of that.
Yeah, and very good book. And a quote in there from you about Stephen A. Smith.
Yeah, I was surprised by that. I was happy to get it. Brandon Buehler is a Seton Hall prof, right?
Yes.
Yes, I had talked to him, like, just email-wise about getting a copy of it, but I did not. I've done, like, interviews with people for books, and usually I don't get quoted, but it is the sort of thing where, you know, anytime maybe someone's writing a book about people from New Jersey who are always wrong and they want to, you know, get my, you know, weigh in on stuff. But in this case, it was kind of a wild quote from, I think, a Vice Sports column that I'd written, which I was delighted to see because it's, you know, at some point, I don't write about Stephen A. that much, but I've been doing this for long enough that I've probably written 10,000 words on the guy. I don't remember that many of them. So I do remember seeing the quote, because I looked, you know, you look in the index, and if you're in there, you're going to go see how you're quoted and why. And it was kind of gratifying to be like, oh, yeah, pretty good. You got to burn it on this guy.
But he's decided, I guess, much like Skip Bayless, that, and obviously right about, that this is the path to, if not glory, then certainly riches.
Yeah, Stephen A. is a weird case because, like, I mean, I feel like he's constantly undergoing these reappraisals where people are kind of, you know, Skip, I think at this point everybody's pretty sick of a bit. There's just not a lot there. You know, he was posting during the Cowboys loss, you know, like, in a way where he was sort of like, this is why I threw my Dak Prescott jersey.
Oh, yes.
This is disgraceful. Everybody's, and I just kept thinking, like, you're 65 years old, man. Like, you don't need to live like this. Like, you've got other stuff in your life, right? Like, you don't need to be, like, setting a jersey on fire on YouTube. Like, you get paid $10 million a year to go on TV. Like, be normal. But he can't. I mean, like, he's in character all the time.
Right.
Stephen A. is a more mysterious figure because I think it's a more complicated performance, but it's more, like, obviously stilted in some ways. Like, he, like, likes to get really emotional about the Knicks and, like, kind of like tear up and make a weird video where it's like mostly dark and he's like, Julius Randle has betrayed me for the last time. And he's sort of like, I don't think you really think that either. But he's doing more stuff, so there's more mystery there. I just think the more you learn about Stephen A. and the bit that he does, the less appealing he becomes. Like, he's kind of like a bit of a creep and a kook. And if you can just accept him as a character who gets up there and, you know, starts blustering and using a lot of, clock-killing phrases so he can try to figure out where it is that he's going with whatever it is he's saying. Not like I would ever do that, by the way. But that version of him is great. The closer you get to seeing the real guy, the more you want the performance, in my opinion.
Well, so much of it is calculated, and I guess that's the part that I'm not crazy about, because to me, the beauty of sport is the spontaneity of it, and that includes the people who talk about it. Now, yes, if you're writing something, I want you to put some thought into it, but I feel like all this has been rehearsed in front of a mirror before we get to see it.
Exactly that. I completely agree. And I think it's one of those things, too, where this is like where it doesn't exactly absolve him, right? But the incentives of the sort of type of sports talk that he does, there's, you know, like your Mike Francesa types that go on the radio and they know that they have to talk about like regular season baseball for 5 hours. Like, I don't envy them in that regard. Like, that's a tough row to hoe, but they know what that is. With Stephen A, it's different because it's like he can't just talk about it, and he can't talk about it in a way that implies that he's surprised by something or has learned something, or is, like, thinking that he's wrong, you know, about something that he thought before. He has to be, like, not just always sort of right and always locked in on stuff, but he has to be the most all the time. It has to be, like, the more infuriated by a random Knicks loss, like, more incensed by the idea that anybody would ever have doubted Jordan Love or whatever. And I just think that's, like, by doing everything at 11, it's like it sucks the fun and the surprise out of it, which again is like you, I think, is the fun of watching sports, is that, and it's the reason why I think it's like the last thing that people, you know, watch on live TV or they don't DVR. Like, if you really don't know what's coming next, that's the fun of it. And I feel like with Stephen A, like, wherever he's going, like, you know exactly how it's going to go and how it's going to sound.
David Roth, Defector, the Distraction Podcast. David, good catching up with you. As always, I hope what's left of January brings you some light and joy here going forward.
And also to you. May Truck Day come soon. And thank you, as always, for having me on. I appreciate you. Have a good one.
Thanks, David. David Roth with us here on Downtown.